Hello, Kathy.
I can't make it.
Where are you going?
I can't tell you that.
Jack, tell her where you're going. In fact, tell her who you work for. She'll be impressed.
I work for the CIA, and the director asked me at the last minute to come with him to Russia to do a nuclear arms inspection.
That is so lame.
Hello?
Welcome back, everyone, to this 42nd episode of Through the Aftermath. I'm your host, Sean. With me once again is Jonathan. How you doing?
Well, actually, we should say, like, thank God still with us today is Jonathan.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, there's probably a lot of people out there that are like, why did everybody go away for a while? And that, I about went up to the Tranquility Lane in the sky there for a little while.
Yeah, you feel like telling people what happened?
Yeah, basically what happened is I got diverticulitis, and it literally, for those who don't know, it's like having appendicitis, except in, it's sort of like a pocket that gets formed in like your intestine or whatever. So like appendicitis, you know, they can just kind of have an operation to cut the piece off. With diverticulitis, by the time you figure out you've got a problem, you're already in trouble. And so all they can do is basically put you in the hospital for over a week and put you on the most insane stuff possible and hope that everything comes down. And, I think the recovery on that one, I was in the hospital for a week, and then I was sick nonstop for about 4 weeks. And then there was a near second time I almost went in the hospital, and it turned out to be a kidney infection, to which I, you know, of course replied, of course, because why not? Right. For a second there, I was kind of worried I wasn't going to be recording the show ever again, but, here we are.
And then you said you had flooding too?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. That was the other thing too. Like right after like the worst time, it was probably the week right before Christmas was on Saturday, you know? And that whole time there was this, we had nonstop rain. And we'd had flooding about 5 years ago that where the area was declared a national disaster zone, and it happened almost again. And there was a dam up north that was about to blow, and it was already knocking houses down again. And yeah, I'm a little bit up on a hill, so I just kind of stood up there, pointed downward, and went special effects. But yeah, great shaders down there. Yeah, I mean, it was the draw distance.
Yeah,
I know. I'm getting a little bit of slow down right now, but I think it's due to the drugs. But, no, it was intense. It was, I think I was the only one laughing because by that time, like, the whole city was, like, sort of in a panic. Like, people were evacuating and stuff, even the ones who lived on mountains. And it was funny because everybody's like, you're not worried? And I'm like, what, are you kidding? After all I just went through, you think I'm worried about water? that was the last thing I was worried about, so.
Yeah.
That was intense. Wow. The kidney infection, I like to tell people that was the DLC for the diverticulitis. Man, only thing that kept me going that week was basically the gamer Hanukkah, as we liked to call that Steam sale during the holidays.
Yeah, that's true.
So, it was crazy.
It's good that you keep a sense of humor about it, though. I mean, I'm sitting here laughing at you, but I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing with you.
It's okay, because you should have seen the laughter for me. When they told me I had a kidney infection, I just busted out laughing. And I'm like, of course. Well, why not? Just keep doing it. Keep coming, you know?
Wow.
But, doing better now, finally. And, you know, I've been able to play. For a while there, the games stopped to almost nothing, and the movies stopped almost nothing, and everything got really weird, and now everything's kind of back on track, so hopefully this is the beginning of more goodness.
Yeah, hopefully. Well, I mean, it's good that you're feeling better. I wasn't, I know, you know, we talked a few times about recording, but, you know, there were things that kept happening, and I wasn't really too worried about it. I knew that our listeners would be you know, they're still going to be here when everything's fine again. So, and I did tweet it, I think twice I tweeted about how we were going to record soon and that you were having some health problems and things like that. So,
yeah.
Yeah. So it's good to be back though, right?
Yeah, it is. It is. And, you know, on to 2011, I mean, it's like, holy cow, you know, just one more year until John Cusack is the only one alive. So that should be, this should be interesting. But, yeah, it's a good year for games, though. My goodness. Games and movies both. We've got a lot of post-apocalyptic or near about post-apocalyptic stuff on the horizon pretty quick. So
I know. I just remember last year at this time we were recording and we were like, oh, 2010 is going to be great. You know, we're going to have The Road and we're going to have Book of Eli. And I remember how excited we were about all that, too.
Yeah, and it keeps going. And
Wait, The Road came out. I think it came out before that. I think it came out in, like, November.
It may have. It may have been just before, because my buddy Rob, who works with me, his brother David had started working for us right at the turn of the year, and I almost want to say, oh, that's right, because he wasn't quite working for us yet. So yeah, you're probably right. It probably was the end of 2009.
Yeah, because I think we were making fun of the fact that it was like a holiday season kind of a movie.
Yeah, it was like, because nothing said family togetherness like The Road.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that's what it was. Yeah. But Book of Eli is the one that came out at the beginning, yeah.
That's right. Yeah, and then The Walking Dead, which ended on the probably the most gut-wrenching, season finale I've ever seen.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
You haven't caught up yet? Okay, hands down, best season finale. Like, it's sort of a story unto itself that opens the door for more, but it had to have been the most interesting, well-written season finale I've seen in a long time.
Oh, man. See, Xbox Live has it for sale. It's like 1,300 Xbox points or something like that, and Microsoft points, and you can, and I'm really tempted to just buy it because we don't have regular TV, and I did watch the first episode on Hulu, but I haven't watched any more, so I'm really tempted to just go ahead and buy it and
just
watch
do
the whole
it.
Thing.
Because every episode, I kid you not, every episode got better and better and better, and then that final episode, you don't get that gut-wrenching feeling where they give you like one answer and give you 400 more. It is definitely a little bit of closure, but they sort of leave something open that's a new element that you're like, oh no, and then all of a sudden, you know, I guess they're green-lighted to do the next season already, so they're probably, cool. These half seasons are killing me. I don't understand these half seasons.
Yeah. It's like, they do that with a lot of shows, and it is frustrating, yeah.
Yeah. Hey.
So, while you had your downtime, were you able to watch any good movies?
Let's see. Post-apocalyptic wise, I did actually recently catch up, and I sat down and watched all three of the Mad Max movies in a row.
Oh,
and it's
nice.
Funny enough, like, I don't, it's weird I'd be saying this, but like, going back and watching them all over again, it's funny that the very, very first one, I came out of it after watching it yet again, for almost like, I don't know, that one just sort of became my favorite out of all of the three of them, even though Road Warrior was, you know, kind of all around. But there's something about the first one just has like a different kind of like a feel to it that I'm like, man, I could go watch that again and still enjoy it, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's just kind of got that, you're not quite sure if it's nuclear war, but everything's kind of trashed. It's just got this feel to it that's so different.
Yeah. Oh, that's absolutely my favorite one. I love that one so much. When I was younger, I used to watch it over and over and over again, and then I bought it. I think when I was in college, and on VHS, and I used to watch it over and over and over again. And I have all the trilogy on DVD now, but it's the same thing. It's like you watch them, and the first one has such a raw, like low budget feel to it, which is just incredible. And then the second one is this, you know, they actually got money, and it's kind of better in a different way. I think I really love Road Warrior. And then, you know, Thunderdome, I think a lot of people hated it because it was the most commercialized. But I still love that.
I love that
many parts of that one. Yeah.
Even the Lord of the Flies part, I still get a kick out. Because after South Park coined the phrase, in Tomorrow Morrowland, I mean, you couldn't stop but laugh after that one.
That's true.
And the before time.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so funny.
So what else? Anything else?
Let's see. Other than that, just been playing Fallen Earth nonstop. Like, my I didn't play it nonstop. I've had my account going the whole time, and I still jump into that one. And that one, that's the one game that has probably outlasted all the others just because there you can play it so casually. You don't have to feel compelled to be part of a group or whatever. Like, sometimes I enjoy, like, this sounds ridiculous, but you'll probably appreciate this more than anybody. Like, the fact that you can sort of just scavenge for materials. Like, there sometimes you have, like, a hard day at work, and then you're like, I'm going to go scavenge for metal. But there's something, yeah, like, peaceful about it. And it must be that kind of, you know, Rubik's Cube, you sit down and just do something methodical that has meaning or something to keep you off from thinking about a bad day.
Yeah, yeah. I could see that. I could see that. It's kind of zen.
It is. It is. It's zen in its own Ender's Game insanity. I don't know. It's been good. These new combat stuff there had kind of changed things up a little bit, and I was kind of like, whoa, wow, what happened while I was gone? But it's been a good game. I'm hoping to see some more post-apocalyptic goodness on the horizon as far as games go, other than the, you know, obviously the Fallout download content for New Vegas, but...
Oh, yeah. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, the storyline is really cool. Funny enough, I haven't been able to play it yet. Everybody who doesn't already know this, you know, obviously the DLC, they had something going with Microsoft where 360 got the exclusive on this way ahead of everybody else, so we're all still waiting PC, PS3. We all don't know when we're going to get it, but the storyline's brilliant. Basically, it's about this casino in the desert that's sort of this ghost town. It was called the Sierra Madre, and basically the idea is when the bombs fell, the radiation got really thick in that particular area, and the whole place went on automatic lockdown by the computers that controlled the thing. And it's sort of like a Morlock story. Like, you end up getting pulled into the whole thing, and you're meeting the people who have lived there, let's say, you know, mutated and changed because of the way that the system worked. It's kind of like, it's got this whole eerie Skynet feel to it. It's really well done. I don't know what to compare it to, but it's almost like kind of like half Morlock, half, you know, computer that's tried to inadvertently kill everybody kind of a thing. It's really wild.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I again, you know, we keep talking about getting a New Vegas show going, and I still haven't gotten really back into it. I did, I think last time we talked, I was saying that I want to finish Fable 3.
Oh, yeah.
I did that, and now I'm on this Mass Effect 2 kick. I have to finish that game.
I loved that. Yeah, I did beat that one, by the way. No, that was one game that is worthy of beating, because that game, that game had me riveted from beginning to end. That's unusual for me. I usually kind of take a break in between, but...
Yeah.
I am curious, though, to see one thing, though, that... I don't know, like, this... While not directly related post-apocalyptic, it may very well be soon, because those of you who don't know, the company that does Fallout, Bethesda, they announced their new Elder Scrolls game called Skyrim in November.
The
beauty of this one is this is the first time that they've done an in-house game engine. They've always licensed that, and I'll be honest, it was always kind of a clunky engine. There was not a lot they could do about it, but it worked for what they needed. Well, it stands to reason if this is their in-house game engine, the next Fallout is likely to be made on this game engine too. And if you see the graphics for Skyrim, your mouth just drops. It's astounding, and I'm like, will the next Fallout look like that? So there's good things on the horizon.
Well, they've actually talked about the fact that, you know, they were going back and forth with Interplay, saying that they were going to, that Interplay still had the rights to the Fallout MMO,
yes.
And now Bethesda's saying, no, actually, we have it. Like,
they're clamping.
Yeah, they say, don't listen to Interplay. And not only that, they're saying, we have the rights to Fallout 5 and 6. You know,
yeah, they,
like,
bought the franchise. That's the thing that was so interesting. They're like, no, we didn't just license it. It's hours.
Yeah.
Which makes sense. That was the whole point.
Yeah. So that's good news.
Yeah, which is good. So, because we know they've, even after playing Fallout New Vegas, as much as I loved it, you know, Fallout 3, it just had a feel to it, and it just goes to show Bethesda, sometimes having the original guys who make the original game can be a lot of fun, but sometimes there are people that, if they're paying close enough attention, might do just as good.
Yeah.
So we'll see what they do next.
Well, cool. I'm trying to think if there was anything that I saw. I can't remember. It's been, what, since November?
I recorded.
But I know that there were some movies I saw, and I like kept thinking, I need to remember this for when we record next. But we've been watching so much stuff. I've been on this kind of disaster kick thing.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen that movie? It's not post-apocalyptic, but have you ever seen that movie Frozen?
I don't know if I have or not. Is it like an Ice Age kind of a thing? Like, well, is that the storyline?
No, it's a recent movie, but what it is these people go on the ski trip, and they're kind of, you know, rambunctious.
Oh, they get stuck on the lift.
Yeah, they get stuck on the lift for a week.
Oh.
And it goes – how this pertains to post-apocalyptic, I think, is it's they kind of freeze, and it goes through the different stages of them freezing. And at one point, you know, I'm not going to give away the story because it's a really, really recent movie. But at one point, one of the guys, he just kind of goes crazy, and he's like, I have to jump. Like, I might be able to make it. If I can jump, I can drag myself down the hill, and I'll get help. And they're like, no, don't do it. And he jumps, and he just snaps his legs, like both of them. And he's paralyzed from the waist down, and he's just sitting there at, you know, below him, and he's just sitting there going, wow. Like, why did I do that? That was really stupid. And the people up in the lift are like, are you okay? And then wolves come.
Oh,
and,
no.
And he hears this howling, and these wolves come, and they literally rip him apart. And it's crazy. Like, the movie is so intense with emotion and about, like, the survival mentality, you know? Like, kind of like, what would I do in that situation? That I think it really applies to us in the show. And I kept thinking about it when I was watching it. I was like, oh, it's such a... You know, like, what would you do if you were stuck in a lift for a week? I mean, it's crazy. But I recommend it. Just from that survival aspect alone, I definitely recommend it.
Well, and usually those simple, you know, premise for a movie end up turning out to be the most insanely well-done film. You know, like, case in point, you know, that movie called Devil. I don't know if you ever saw that one where the guys are in the elevator and the one, they think that the devil's in there. And it sounds ridiculous in concept. It was probably one of the coolest movies I'd seen. Like, I was like, this is really well done. And it was, you know, a similar thing. You know, the ski lift, taking a very simple idea, you know, leave it to these, you know, film school students or whoever these guys who do this kind of thing, you know, Paranormal Activity, those kind of movies where it's a simple concept, but they do so much with it that's old school filmmaking.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, man. There needs to be more.
Yeah. I mean, this Frozen movie, it wasn't very high budget. You know, it was the acting was kind of cheesy in some parts and things like that. But I thought the premise itself was pretty incredible. And it was one of those that really makes you think, like, wow, like, that's, you know, if you were in that situation, you probably would go crazy, too. You know, your mind is, like, freezing. And, you know, you're like, maybe I can jump. That might be a good idea. But it definitely was not.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's a good movie.
Yeah, I'll have to check that one out.
Yeah, definitely, when you get a chance. It's I'm trying to think of if there was any other ones. I know that I saw... Let's see, I finished watching all the Day of the Triffids, the original ones and the new ones.
Mm-hmm.
And then I watched... seems like I watched a zombie one. Oh, I can't remember what it was called. But it wasn't good at all. It was like... I can't remember what the name of it was. It was such a... It was probably the worst zombie movie I've ever seen. I wish I could remember it. I should have written it down.
Yeah, we got a couple on the horizon, too. A couple of, like, post-apocalyptic almost style movies.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, what do we got? Like, Battle Los Angeles. That's the one that looks to be really, really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically, it is sort of post-apocalyptic. I guess they say that after this alien invasion, that Los Angeles is the last city that has anybody pretty much alive at all. And these guys are the ones that fight back against these aliens. And then there's actually a... I don't know. Have you seen the previews for the Fallen Skies, I think is what it's called? The one with Noah Wiley where it's a TV series coming out by Spielberg that is it starts 3 months after these aliens have taken over our planet. And it's about how it's sort of like V-style, except I guess from the get-go, they're obviously hostile. But these aliens, they don't show anything in the preview, but all it shows is that they're building this resistance group in general and... it looked really good. Although, and funny enough, V, I haven't watched it this season, but I've had about four people go, you have to watch it. I'm like, really? What? What? So, yeah, apparently there's something really good going on there, too. So.
Cool. That's good to hear. That's cool. I always loved V. When I was, I must have been in third grade or second grade when V came out.
Scared the living crap out of me as a kid.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Oh, good times. That girl, the main girl, she had the really, like, clear eyes, like they were so light, they were clear. Oh, that was freaky. Yeah. Good times. Well, you want to go ahead and get into the main topic of this show? We actually do have a main topic. What we're going to talk about is The Sum of All Fears, which is a movie with Ben Affleck, and it was originally a book by Tom Clancy. And that, what we're going to talk about is kind of mostly the movie, because the movie was, you know, a little bit more, more people, I guess, saw the movie. It did really well in the box office, and it came out in, like, 2002. And then the book itself, there were a lot of differences, and we'll talk about that, too. And Jonathan read the book, so that will be kind of what we'll cover there. But you want to talk a little bit about what the movie, kind of the general basic premise of the movie?
Yeah, basically the idea is, and like you said, we're going kind of off of the movie here. The idea is it kind of starts up right after the Israeli war back in 1973, where there was an Israeli jet that lost one of their nuclear weapons in the desert in Syria. And in the movie, they portray it a little bit different. Basically, in the movie, it was kind of buried over time, and these guys end up digging it up and end up selling it to an arms dealer who in turn sells it to the main bad guys of the story, which is there's an Austrian neo-Nazi named Richard Dressler. And the idea is he has this whole neo-Nazi group that he's been rallying up people around the world. And the idea is that he wants to punish America and Russia for basically failing to stay socialist, which what they're doing too is they're playing off of some of the ideas, you know, that Russia has changed by now. And it's interesting. One of the lines that he says in this that I find interesting as kind of a side point is he basically quotes Adolf Hitler, but he says basically that Hitler was smart, but that he was sloppy, and that what he did was he tried to go after both the Russians and the Americans, and that was sloppy to do, because what you should do is actually get them to fight each other. And so that in and of itself is the storyline for this, is this neo-Nazi group basically playing the Americans against the Russians and vice versa. And so, long story short, they take this nuclear weapon that they got from Syria, and they use it to build a bomb that gets put in Baltimore during one of the Super Bowls. And that's what's actually kind of cool about this story, is you get a lot of stories that are like, what if something bad happened? But somehow they avert it. But in what's cool about this story is it happens. The bomb goes off right in the middle of the Super Bowl. And so the last half of the movie is everything coming apart, and basically the paranoia and fear and what do we do? This has never happened before, of both Russia and the Americans, because you know, both of them are waiting for the other to make these moves. And in this part of the story, the Russians have a new president. And this guy is so concerned about, you know, seeming like he's going to play hardball at all times. He's actually like taking credit for attacks that happened on Chechnya that he didn't even do, because he doesn't want to seem weak to, you know, the people around him. And that actually ends up kind of playing into it too. And likewise, you know, we've got guys in the government here in America where they're, you know, refusing to, they're going to be after us. We got to hit them really hard. And, you know, that's exactly what the neo-Nazis want to have happen. And it's just a really cool story about how how the fear of everything can come together, and how much can just cascade downward from there.
Yeah, exactly. And that was the thing is, you know, originally what happened at the very beginning of the movie and the book too is during the 1973 war, the Yom Kippur War, there was America provided Israel with nuclear weapons, and you know, one of these nuclear bombs, it was like a bomb that was dropped, not a missile. One of these bombs was on a plane that got shot down, an Israeli plane. And it got lost in Syria, and some scrap dealers, or you know, people who go around looking for scrap, they found this, and they knew it was a bomb. They knew they could probably get a lot of money for it on the black market, and they sold it to, you know, the first guy who came along and wanted to get it. So and that was the eventually it got to that neo-Nazi guy, and he bought this bomb, and you know, with hopes of, like you said, kind of pitting the Soviet Union and the U.S. against each other to defeat each other, and you know, the two superpowers, getting them out of the way. So he did this with a U.S. made bomb, which was the irony here. And he got it. He put it into a vending machine, and he took it. He got it taken to the Super Bowl, and that's how it blew up. But the thing here is that it's such a it's one of those things where we don't, you know, we think, oh, nuclear war, this is going to happen when this country, now, you know, our fears are North Korea, or, you know, Pakistan has nuclear weapons, Iran, and those are our fears now as far as nuclear weapons. We think of nuclear missiles, you know, being fired at the U.S. or England or whoever else. well, this kind of approaches it from like a back doorway. You know, it's like, well, this is a bomb that was made in 1968. You know, it was used in a war in 1973, and it's been sitting in the desert for 30 years, you know, and then now it's brought back, and it's kind of came back to haunt us in a way that we don't think of. And something like that is, it's I don't want to sound like it's, you know, so possible, but it is possible. You know, you get a dirty bomb like that, which is kind of the big fear. You get a dirty bomb, which is made by some people, you know, in their basement, I guess, you know, there's some really intelligent kind of lower sects out there that can create things like this. And they can get that, and they can do something like that, you know, put it in something and just blow up, not the entire world, but, you know, enough to make a huge impact, like at a Super Bowl.
Yeah.
So I think that from that aspect, it really, you know, you take out the Ben Afflecks and you take out the, you know, the disaster movie part of it, and you get to that core of it right there, and it's kind of scary. It's kind of scary that kind of stuff could happen, and that's why I like this movie. It plays to that part of it, kind of the lead up to it, and then it plays past that. Like you said, you know, how would the governments respond? And the funny thing here is that it's because of some tension between the Soviet Union and the U.S. at this time that this was happening. They were both kind of blaming each other. They're both kind of, you know, the U.S. is blaming Russia for this attack, and then they're you know, the Chechenian bombings, and they're shooting down planes, and they're kind of picking at each other. And it's almost like what North and South Korea are, you know, were doing a couple months ago, where they were, you know, doing some test runs. South Korea was, and then North Korea was like, oh, we have to retaliate. And that stuff could escalate really quickly. And the way this movie was played out, it was like this stuff was about to escalate really quickly. I mean, they were about to set the launch codes and destroy the world, you know, and it would all have been over this misunderstanding that no one really clarified, you know. And I think that was another good part of the movie. It's like so ready to jump down each other's throats, you know.
Yeah.
It's, I don't know. It's scary stuff.
Yeah, well, and it's cool, too, because one thing they did well in the movie that I really liked, and this is a good place to explain one of the differences, in the book, there a lot of what cascaded were because of a lot of just plain incompetence on the part of both sides. You know, there was actually a character that wasn't in the movie if you remember, you've seen the movie Clear and Present Danger?
Yeah.
Remember how there was that, there was the National Security Advisor, she was the one who was basically having an affair with the guy who worked for the drug cartel, and he was using her to get the information of where the government was up to?
Yeah.
Yeah, she plays a tiny role in the movie Clear and Present Danger. Well, her character transitions over to Sum of All Fears. She still hates Jack Ryan for what happened there, and she's half of the reason things basically knocked down. And one thing that I like that they did do in the movie is rather than be just pure incompetence, a lot of it was just shock and panic. It was almost like, holy crap, we've trained for this, but when it finally happens, what do we do? And everybody on both sides, the Russian side and the our side, they're just in shock of the fact that a bomb had just gone off. And I mean, you know, the president misses it by just narrow margin of being, you know, one of the main characters ends up getting killed by it. But it's from there, a lot of it's just panic and everybody just freaking out, which is precisely what the faction intended. You know, they weren't trying to necessarily, you know, take out an entire city. They were trying to make it look like, you know, the Russians were instigating this attack and then just, you know, playing their pieces just right all over the board. And like you said, it's the way that fear can work. You know, it's interesting how, you know, quickly things can cascade as well. If actually, funny enough, here I am just talking about that flood we had here. You know, it's a flood that's in a riverbed that, you know, everybody knows where it's at. And yet when we have this flooding, half the people, even the ones living in the mountains, are bailing out of the city, evacuating my city. And I'm looking at them going, wait, you're up on the hill. It's not like Noah, where it's going to come up and cover the mountain, but yet the fear alone, you know, common sense was gone. And these people were leaving the city as if they were about to have this, like, end-of-the-world event. And it was interesting to note, you know, all it was a little flood, and that's all it took for people to unravel just based on paranoia and things they would hear on the radio, and you know, that plays right into this. You know, how bad would it have to be before the world just assumed that everything was just falling apart?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at something like Hurricane Katrina, you know, when that happened, I think it was a good example of what would happen in a big city if there was a giant, I mean, it was a giant disaster, but if there was some kind of more of a worldwide disaster, mm-hmm. you know, I think as a sampling what happened in New Orleans, you know, people just lost it. Like, they didn't really know what to do, and, you know, there was just kind of going through and looting everything, and you know, it just seemed like no one was really prepared for it. And I think that there will, if something like this happened, you know, on a worldwide scale, I think people would be more prepared. But there are certainly people who are not going to be prepared, and I think that that's going to be pretty widespread. And I think, like you said, that this movie portrays that, portrays the panic and the, you know, all the training and all the stuff we learn kind of goes down the drain at that moment. You know?
Which is interesting, because you notice the first scene that you see our president and the cabinet in is they're in this mock, you know, what, you know, mock scenario of an attack going to DEFCON 1, and it's all a simulation, you know, a training exercise, and yet a little while later it really does happen, and all the training's out the window. It's almost like when panic sets in, everything's just lost, and that's one of the interesting things, and I think, truthfully, one of the things that I found the most fascinating about, you know, the post-apocalyptic things in general or the emergency preparedness is sometimes the preparedness is there not just because of, you know, food and water, but because of the mentality that comes with it and the fact that you're well on your way to knowing what you need to do when the rest of the world is still blinking going, what do we do, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think just the fact that it happened, like, this happened at a Super Bowl, and ironically, the Super Bowl is coming up here pretty soon.
Yeah, this is true.
But it happened. I mean, it killed what, like, tens of thousands of people, you know, in the movie, and it pretty much leveled Baltimore. Which in the book, it happened in Denver, right?
Yeah, in the book, it was in Denver, and it also, yeah. Funny enough, the president wasn't even there. He actually had listened to his cabinet and not gone.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, so, I mean, this happened, in the movie, it happened in Baltimore, wiped out, you know, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people, and it's still, when you think about it, that would be incredibly devastating. I mean, not only that, they were even showing a little bit about kind of the after effects, and, you know, his girlfriend at the time, who was played by Bridget Moynihan, she was a doctor, or she's in the hospital, and they were showing, you know, kind of the aftermath there and kind of the panic, which it reminds me of a lot of other disaster movies like that, or, you know, like The Day After, I think.
Mm-hmm. That everybody well. In the gymnasium at the schools and... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I think it was cool that it showed that, and it kind of showed a little bit. But I just wish the movie focused... I mean, I guess the movie wasn't about that. It was more of a political movie. But I just felt it didn't really show a lot of the aftermath stuff. And here I am, you know, on a podcast called Through the Aftermath. Of course, I'm going to say that. You know, I wish that it would have shown a little bit more of that. And I guess there are movies that tackle that a little bit more specifically. But I just felt like this one kind of brushed over a lot of that. So what I'm wondering is, did they go into more detail in the book about the aftermath stuff?
Yeah, they actually do. And interesting enough, there's quite a bit involving other countries, because Russia was primarily the one they were playing against us. One thing that's interesting is the reason that the bomb goes off at the Super Bowl and it's minor is because they goofed. There was actually a screw up, and they basically killed their physicist before he was finished making the bomb because they thought they could take it from there. And so when it went off, it didn't go off all the way. And it, funny enough, they call it a fizzle, which, you know, anybody who's playing online games is like, hey, you know, because we know exactly what that means. But what's interesting, same time, they're basically attacking, acting like they're attacking U.S. forces in Berlin, pretending to be East Germans, and so they've got both sides playing against each other there. And what it actually ends up being is there is a Muslim extremist group. They're terrorists, and they're a group basically, I can't remember the name, but they're some kind of like Front for the Liberation of Palestine or something like that. And the idea is they're angry because we never did – They couldn't continue the war with Israel, like, you know, back in the 70s. They're still jaded from that. And part of the reason they changed it to the neo-fascist group is because at the time that the movie was made, they were probably thinking that something like that was less likely. But also because, you know, a neo-fascist group, I mean, it's funny because you look at the story of what they – what their mentality is like and the kind of people that would play into, and you've got a lot of money rolling around in there. You know, it would make sense that a guy from Austria, some scientist out of Austria would have all this money and would be, oh yeah, get us a bomb and we'll take it from there. And there, those of you out there who probably also made this connection that I just made when I was watching the movie again, I was sitting there watching the story and I go, wait a minute, this is Call of Duty 4. That was exactly what I was thinking the whole time. Wait a minute, Call of Duty 4, it's the same story. You know, obviously, you know, not necessarily location-wise, but neo-fascist group, bomb goes off, you know, in this case, Saudi Arabia, I think is where it went off, but, yeah, there's this whole part in the book, though, that is playing these groups in the Middle East are being played into it, and the things that are happening there, and, you know, Morgan Freeman's character in the book is just a bumbling idiot, and he actually, his character is almost like kind of passed over a little bit compared to the movie. The movie did that well. I liked the fact that he was sort of this, you know, brains behind a lot of what happened, and he had this secret contact with the Kremlin who didn't want to reveal himself, kind of a thing. Loved that. Loved that part of the movie.
Yeah, I think that the biggest part of the differences, I think, is definitely, like, who had the bomb, right?
Right.
I mean, because, like you said, it was a Muslim extremist group versus neo-Nazi group. I was looking at the Wikipedia page, and it reminded me that back when this came out, this actually came out in 2002, like, probably about 8 months after September 11th. And a lot of people were saying, well, maybe did they change that, you know, from the book to the screenplay? Did they change it because of 9/11? Like, they didn't want to upset anyone? And the guy who wrote it, the screenplay, was saying, no, it's, you know, we had this written before 9/11 happened, and it really didn't have anything to do with it. We just were kind of, you know, going for more of a different viewpoint. You know, I think he thought that the whole Muslim being, you know, the bad guy kind of a thing was played out. And so he was kind of going from a different angle there.
Yeah.
But I think that was probably the biggest change. And like you mentioned, you know, a couple character changes. There are a couple characters that are in the book that aren't even in the movie at all. And then there's the, you know, kind of Morgan Freeman's character was more of a noble, you know, like a much more intelligent guy than in the book.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's one thing that I think I did like a lot was it kind of took out a lot of the idiocy of things, because as much as a lot of people will get involved in the, you know, the politics and so-and-so's, you know, their competence level, that type of thing. You know, sometimes I think that it is kind of, you know, it's always fitting to see that they're, you know, despite what people see on the outside, that inside there's usually, you know, I like the idea of smart people who are behind the scenes kind of storylines. And it in the movie actually did that really well compared to the book. But the book, don't get me wrong, book was incredible. But the movie just did a couple of things that I thought were really cool too. You know, and Ben Affleck, you know, there's automatically that want to hate Ben Affleck mentality. I will say that as I watched the movie, I tuned out the fact that it was Ben Affleck. But I got to say, you know, Jack Ryan, he's a sacred character. You don't mess with Jack Ryan. You got to find somebody who's worthy of the character. Liv Schreiber, on the other hand, incredible job.
Oh, yeah.
In the movie.
I love
Schreiber
that guy.
Was great.
I love it.
Sabretooth.
There was a movie he did recently, I loved it. I don't know. I'll never remember it here while I'm recording, but I'll have to look it up later. But I love him. He's a great actor. And I think what was funny, too, is I saw this on the wiki page, and I didn't even put two and two together because I didn't read all the books, all of Tom Clancy, the Jack Ryan series. So what I thought was funny was that the movie itself is supposed to happen, it's set in 2002. But in the book, it's 1991. So now this is the fourth in the Jack Ryan film series. Well, they have him portrayed as actually younger than he is in The Hunt for Red October, which was set in 1984.
Yeah.
And I think that's funny. And then there were other sequels from Hunt for Red October, which were Patriot Games and Clear and Present Danger, which were set before Some of All Fears. And you can't tell me that Ben Affleck is older than Harrison Ford. You know what I mean? It's like, that was a little continuity.
Playing.
Yeah, a little continuity thing there that I think they just kind of skipped over.
Well, even his character, like in the book, he was actually, like in the movie, he's sort of a junior analyst. You can tell he's kind of being played off as this, even he's kind of the bumbling idiot in the story. Well, in the movie, or in the book, I mean, he's actually in charge of that. He's like one of the main people in charge of that section of the CIA, which was kind of cool. But I liked, you know, I see why they kind of took the story a different way, because there were so many transitions over from the last book, characters who were in the last story, people who came to help him based on of clear and present danger. But in this one, they kind of wanted to, okay, we've got a story to tell, we want to keep it quick. And the thing I did like, though, not to spoil it for anybody who hasn't seen it, but the very end sequence when they meticulously, all parties involved who'd been played, simultaneously basically go after the faction group who done this all, it's brilliant. Just the way that, you know, like the guy having the bodyguard turn on his car for him because he's like, oh good, there's no bomb, and then he pushes the cigarette lighter and the car goes off, you know? Stuff like that. I'm like, you know, you feel vindicated at the end, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I could see that. And you know what? I hate to change the subject here, but I just thought of who that movie I was thinking
yeah,
of.
Yeah, yeah, dude.
Liv Schreiber. That movie I love was called Defiance. You ever seen that?
The one where they're in the forest in Germany.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not in Germany, but like against Germany.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that was a incredible movie.
Yeah.
This is my forest wife. Yeah, Liv Schreiber, I love him because I was one of those, you know, silly me for being the comic guy. I actually got into the X-Men Wolverine, you know, origins story. Like, I didn't get a chance to see the movie till well after video. But that was one where I was like, oh, Liv Schreiber's in it, you know, and you know, Sabretooth, they're like, holy crap, keep him in there, you know. I've always liked Liv Schreiber. He's always been a great actor.
Yeah.
But
well, cool. one thing I wanted to mention too, that before we let go of this topic. I do have some emails I wanted to read, too, but there was a news story recently, and this kind of ties to the whole nuclear explosion thing. There was a news story recently about Chernobyl, and we talked about Chernobyl quite a few episodes ago, and kind of, you know, we explained how it went down and what happened exactly and you know, how it all happened in 1986. Well, now, there's this new study that found that there's actually life coming back to Pripyat. You know, it's the whole Chernobyl area is basically coming back, and now not all of it. And that's the interesting thing, is that here we are, you know, what, 86 to now, however many years that is later, 30,
mm-hmm.
30
yeah.
years, and so we have all of this stuff coming back, and they're noticing that. Now, this is my favorite part. They're noticing that trees and plant life, there is certain plant life that's growing and adapting itself, kind of like locking out the cells from the radiation and kind of adapting itself to the radiation. And it's able to thrive in what is still some radiation that humans can't really even go in all this time later. But there are trees, and they have these pictures of it, and there are trees just growing everywhere. You know, it's thriving for this certain kind of plant life. Now, they're finding that certain animals still aren't able to live there. You know, there are even insects that aren't able to live there. Of course, cockroaches can. But there are birds, certain migratory birds, that can't at all. Like, they're really, really sensitive to radiation, and they can't live there at all. But I just thought it was so – and I'm going to link this in the show notes. I actually had a link on our Twitter a couple weeks ago, but I just find the whole story so fascinating. This research that they've done, they found that that certain things are able to thrive and certain things aren't at all. So it makes you think, you know, if there was some kind of a nuclear disaster that wiped out humanity, I guess, that certain things would come back, and others would not at all. It's almost like, it reminds me of that movie, The Time Machine, where,
yes, exactly. You
know, yeah, like everything goes, like
everything the cherries goes away. Were the size of the dude's head.
Yeah, yeah, but everything goes away while he's sitting in the time machine, and then it all comes back, and like the trees come up out of the ground,
like lush as could be.
Yeah, yeah, and it's just lush. So it's kind of funny because it's like that actually would happen.
proof. That's the thing. And I've always been kind of a believer of that too. You know, and I don't diss on anybody who, you know, is concerned about, you know, global warming or anything like that. But you know, I've always been one of those who believed in, you know, I mean, maybe it did come rooted from reading books like The Time Machine that this planet, you know, would while we could influence things in it, would ultimately prevail in and of itself, outlive us by far, you know. And it's interesting to see something, you know, like that only, how, you know, what, 30 years ago, and it's already changed and coming back in its own interesting way. And obviously we don't know what the long-term ramifications of something like that are, but it is interesting and nice to see that there is, you know, that good that has come out of it.
Yeah.
And I got to admit, I made the I don't know if you picked up on this, but the minute I read that story, there's that automatic, stereotype, is this going to be? I made the automatic Fallout link. Have you gotten to the part in Fallout Vegas where you find Vault 22, the vault that's been overrun with plants?
No, I haven't.
As soon as I read that story, because there was radiation, there were these plants in there that had gone all haywire. As soon as I read that story, the first thing I think is Vault 22, and I start laughing, and then I felt embarrassed because that's the first thing I thought of was Fallout. Here it is, you know, Chernobyl. You know what? I could think of something like Stalker if it was going to be game related. No. Fallout New Vegas. That's the first thing that comes to mind. So this is my public apology for being that predictable. No.
Yeah, so. Well, I think also another thing that's really interesting here is they talk about you think about mutation, you know, like you're saying, and you think about, well, would plants be mutated and be like these huge, you know, half man, half plant, like in Fallout kind of a thing? You know, would that actually happen, like Harry? But the thing is, they're talking about there's some catfish that are swimming in pools of water where the reactor actually was. And these catfish are huge. Like, they're just enormous,
wow,
huge catfish. But you would think, oh, well, that's from the radiation. No, it's actually because they don't have any predators. Like, they're just living.
Yeah.
And catfish can get huge.
The ecosystem's been interrupted.
Yeah, exactly. And they have all the food they want, you know. All the algae and all that stuff is growing there. And they're just able to, you know, it's like a heaven for them. So I think that's interesting.
Yeah, it'll be kind of cool
to see. Yeah, yeah. So I'm excited to see, you know, in another 30 years what happens if they leave it all alone, which I imagine they will because the radiation is still there. You know, it's still in the area, in the soil, everything, and you can't really do anything with that.
Yeah, they haven't found the GEC kit yet. We're convinced it's somewhere underneath the reactor, but, we can't go look yet. I did it again. There it is. Not even 5 minutes later, John makes the Fallout joke again.
Talk I know.
It's the drugs. It was the drugs from a month ago.
Well, before we go on the show, I wanted to read. I have a couple emails here that, these are some of these. I haven't even looked at this account. It's through the Aftermath account for a long time, a couple months. And some of them are like, hey, where are you guys at? But we have some back from early December, and I wanted to read these because I thought they were pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
This first one is from Aiken from Los Angeles, and he writes to us a lot. Good friend of the show. He says, hey guys, glad you're liking The Walking Dead. If you're interested in hanging out in a forum about it, I'd recommend roamersandlurkers.com.
Oh.
I could put a link to that in the show notes. Anyway, Fallout New Vegas. I'm loving this game. I've already maxed out my character, and I've hardly dented the main quest line. There's just so much to do and so much to explore. I can't decide which sidekick I like most, Felicia Day or the sniper guy. I'm sorry to hear about the problems with Fallen Earth. I really enjoyed that game for the, 8 months or so that I played, often with one of you. But alas, nothing lasts forever, and I moved on. I don't know how folks who've been playing, Ultima Online since the early 90s managed to do it. I hope this isn't the beginning of the end or anything. Fallen Earth will always have a warm place in my heart. Okay, back to The Walking Dead. Yes, I'm typing this up as I listen. I love when people do that, when they type as they're listening to the show. he says, Rick is with King County, Georgia. What's your source for that? Do you know the answer to that?
Where did we get that? What's the question again? I sort of missed that.
He says, Rick.
Yeah.
In the thing, he says, basically, how did we get that he's from King County, Georgia?
Because, how did we deduce that from the story?
Yeah.
Basically, he said, because that's what he tells them. I mean, they talk about having been, you know, Atlanta is where most of the story takes place in the city, but he says that, he mentions it in the story, somewhere in the beginning, that that's the city that he lived in when he, you know, first gets out of the hospital as part of it, and, you know, just in conversation, just kind of pieced it together. That's funny, because I couldn't actually tell you precisely where, but I think it was just sort of he mentions it a couple times, and you start to piece it all together that that's where he's from.
Yeah, I think so. Because, he says here he was from Cynthiana, Kentucky in the comic. But he says, I've been curious as to where he's from. Guess that answers one of my questions. Another is, what kind of tank did they use? It's not an M1 or an M60, the two American tanks of the past 40 years or so.
It was probably the tank they could afford. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't notice that either. I didn't catch that. But yeah, because I was thinking it was just, you know, like, you know, some standard tank. But I guess, I wonder if it's one, it's because the National Guard, the National Guard, I don't know if they have any, the tanks that they use any different, or if they're one they would pull out in specific situations, or if it would just always be the standard ones. But that is an interesting question. We might have to find the answer to that one.
My grandpa drove a tank in World War II, and I'm horrible because I don't remember off the top of my head which one it was, but yeah, I think that would make sense if it was a National Guard one. Are you looking that up right now?
Yeah, as we speak, funny enough, you can hear the tap-tap as John goes, no, I got to find this out, I can't not know.
Here, I'll finish the rest of his email here. It says, the zombies in TWD do occasionally use simple tools, like rocks, true, but they've been doing that as far back as the original Night of the Living Dead, when one used a rock to break Barbara's car window, and the little girl used a spade to kill her mother. I think, actually, someone pointed that out when we were talking about that in the forums for The Walking Dead. Anyway... He says, what bugged me the most was the zombie going over the fence. In this show, the producers have said that the fresher the zombie, the more it can do. The really fresh ones can make it over a fence, and some of them can shamble along at a rapid clip. As for 28 Days Later, Kirkman says he's never seen it when he wrote the first comic back in 2003. Definitely a strange coincidence, but weirder things have happened in Hollywood. The movie Infected, he says, meh. All right, I guess, but not that great in my humble opinion. But no zombies in the film. A zombie is a reanimated corpse, not a living human suffering from some virus or infection that makes you go psycho. If you've got a good enough hiding spot, you can outlast the infected if you just keep your head down for a month or so, month or two, until they starve to death. In 28 days later, Left 4 Dead, Zombieland, no zombies to be found anywhere. That is a very important distinction there. We say zombies kind of as a general term, I think, but shame on us, right?
Yeah, that's right.
he says, mind you, infected can be scarier than zombies, since they run at you. We shan't talk about the awful Dawn of the Dead remake with the sprinting corpses. he says, what can I say? I'm a zombie purist. The ICBM off the coast here, now this is a... He's kind of going along with listening to it here, so there's many topics. The ICBM off the coast here, and that was in L.A., says, while we'll probably never know for sure, I'm convinced it was a contrail from a jet that had been distorted by the wind and was seen from just the right angle. I've seen very similar contrails myself, and there are many pictures online that show virtually identical distorted contrails. Either that, or it was a secret test. anyway, can't That's wait awesome. For the next episode. Talk to you guys later. Aiken from Los Angeles. Cool.
I'll be doggone. That's cool.
I always like hearing from him. So did you find anything?
Yeah, it is an Abrams.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
And it's funny because there's one guy that actually was saying that it wasn't, because he goes, well, how come the tank's an Abrams in the long shots, and then when it gets up close, it's a British chieftain?
Oh.
And then there's another guy who basically says, like, I don't know what you're talking about. Everything that else that I've seen is kind of leaning toward it being an Abrams, and it's hard to tell whether that's actually a assumption just from the look of it or what. But the colors of it almost kind of make it look National Guard style. But
yeah, I guess that would make the most sense.
Yeah.
But cool. All right, well, we have another email here. This is from David in Houston. And he says, hey, Sean, Jonathan, I'm a little bit behind in listening to podcasts, so forgive me if you've already covered responses. Hey, David, that's all right, because we're a little behind in recording them, so maybe you're caught up by now. He says, I don't watch many movies, but I read a lot, and I've been watching a lot of PA-centric television. So in no real order, The Stand, the book extended version, there's a chapter that talks about random people and how they die from small mistakes. The toddler who falls down the covered shaft and breaks bones, waiting to die, was particularly memorable and horrifying. I mean, you survive Captain Trips and they succumb to a stupid mistake. It'd be my biggest fear. In Threads, near the very end, where the small group of people are eking out an existence farming with a newer generation of kids unable to speak coherently, how fast we fall. In Survivors, the BBC original series, says they talked and showed a lot about the packs of dogs attacking people, but in the two parts Lights of London episode, when they have to fend off the rats, that was pretty scary. Try shooting a rat in the dark. That's a good point. In Jeremiah, the TV show, he says the 15 years that encompassed the time from the release of the virus to the start of the show, really the years that were, for the most part, left for your imagination. I mean, imagine the horror if you were a young kid, your parents, every adult you knew had just died. What do you do now? And then Day of the Triffids, he says, shortly after everyone wakes up, realizes they are blind, and start wandering around outside, calling out for help. The horrors you would see as one of the few sighted people left. But the couple the main guy sees jump out the window was pretty horrifying. Thanks for the show, David in Houston. I think those are good points. He's kind of taking it from a different angle, you know, by naming his scariest moments of all these books and movies and everything. He's taking it from a different angle than the normal, you know, what you would expect. And he's kind of, I really like the Stand one that he mentions, because I really I remember relating to that and reading that chapter and being like, hey, you know, that's true. Like, we kind of all work together as a support group, especially like with this toddler who doesn't have a, you know, any kind of a support, and then they probably wouldn't survive. You know, you think of other types of people who probably wouldn't survive, maybe certain disabilities, you know, cerebral palsy, things like that, who kind of depend on other people to keep them going. And what would they do? I mean, that is scary.
Yeah, all I can say is just keep watching Walking Dead.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's interesting, and you'll know what I'm talking about when you get to it, because yeah, that you that was the first thing I thought of as you were just now saying that. I'm like, oh, that episode. Yeah, there's some interesting stuff. Yeah.
I'm gonna go buy that right after this.
So good. The last episode was so good. And everything, by the way, everything is leaning toward it being that chieftain tank, because I guess the Abrams does not have a hatch on the bottom.
Oh, okay.
And so it's leaning toward there being a chieftain. However, the one argument is that what would that be doing in the middle of Atlanta? So that, yeah, who knows? Maybe some old guy just took off in it. I don't know.
let's see. Okay, we have one more email. And this was actually only sent 3 days ago. That's amazing.
Oh.
And this is from David from Houston as well. He says, hey, guys, I don't know if you ever run out or worry about running out of ideas for intros. Do you need any suggestions? I guess if you put out a request to the listeners, you would get more than you need. That's a good idea. I mean, you and I have talked about kind of recycling intros, you know, because, you know, you're a busy guy and I don't want to be like, you gotta get an intro in. You gotta do that. You know. So it's kind of like the intros have become a, you know, if Jonathan has the time and things like that, which has been working out well. But that might be a good idea. Like if other people have something, maybe they want to do for a little intro, and it doesn't have to be like a skit or anything. Maybe even like this is so and so, and you're listening to the
Aftermath. Please do, seriously.
Yeah, I think that would be a good idea. We could do something like that, like the SM Sterling one where he just said, basically, this is SM Sterling, and you're listening to Through the Aftermath. So,
yeah, we're all for it. I think the only reason we did the skits was just because, you know, we just kind of have fun with the joking on the side, and it just kind of became a habit. But we'd be all for that, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be a nice kind of a fill-in between the bigger skits. You know, and the reason we do the skits is because you're so awesome at them. So that's that's the reason. So.
I appreciate that.
but yeah, I mean, if you guys want to send stuff in, definitely. I would love that. I think that would be cool. And then he explains a little bit, and he says, my idea stemmed from the 72-hour survival kit episode. That got me looking into maybe starting to store food for emergencies. Now to get my wife on board. He says, the rough idea would feature Murkowski and Jonathan in the bunker after the apocalypse. They start to open up the 5-gallon buckets of food, only to find that Murkowski substituted the food for collectibles. Maybe trading cards, post-apocalyptic books, music, toys, stuff that he valued and wanted to be kept in good condition by packing in Mylar. This sends Jonathan over the edge, of course. It ends with Murkowski proudly showing off the MP3 player loaded with Through the Aftermath podcasts. That's hilarious.
That's a great one.
That's a good idea. Okay, so sorry if the unsolicited idea is unwanted, and thanks for letting me indulge you with my intro. Keep the shows coming. No, it's definitely wanted. And even then, like, I think what he's saying, like I was saying, if people want to do one, but even then, having an idea if you still want to do it.
Oh, like, yeah.
I think that would be cool, too. Like, that's what he's saying here.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And any ideas, like, throw it, because it's funny, because you'd be shocked at how much, like, the ideas will click. Like, I've had a few where I almost got to the wire, and I was like, man, I've just got nothing. And all of a sudden, boom, like, something will just go off like a bomb. But sometimes it's usually somebody joking about something where the best stuff has come into play. Like, you know, on a podcast somewhere, talking with somebody, and all of a sudden somebody makes a joke, and all of a sudden your eyes, you know, you see my eyes get wide, and that's what brought up the joke of Rob going, you just got a skit out of that, didn't you? Because that's what people see, that look in my face, and they're like, oh, skit, there it is.
Skit look.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, definitely. Anybody wants to send stuff like that in, simple intro, ideas for intros, any of that stuff. We're kind of a community podcast, and we like to think we are, so I think that stuff's definitely welcome. So, yeah.
Yeah, anything you can do, that would be good. Yeah, and you, like we said, you know, if you have an intro you want to put in, or even something you want to say, or even little thing you want to add, yeah, totally.
Yeah.
That'd be great to get a little more, the audience involvement.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, cool. I guess that's probably about it for this show. We've kind of caught up and had a little topic there and caught up a little bit on news. But we will hopefully do this again in about 2 weeks or so. In March, I'll be gone for most of March, but we'll probably get some good episodes out in February, I'm sure.
Yeah, what is in March? Is that GDC?
Oh, GDC, EVE Fan Fest, PAX East. There's all kinds of stuff.
Are you going to the Fan Fest? In Iceland one?
I'm trying. I don't know if it'll
be
possible.
Oh, you lucky devil. I was going to try to go so bad. That's probably going to be my goal of next year, is to try to go to that. If for any other reason, then it's Iceland.
Oh, yeah.
Who gets to say that?
I know.
That'd be so awesome.
Crossing my fingers and toes.
Yeah.
But, but yeah, if anyone wants to send us an email, you can send it to ttaftermath@gmail.com. Also, we have the main site at throughtheaftermath.blogspot.com, and we have our Twitter, which usually whenever we have a new episode or some news we find, things like that, we'll tweet on there, and it's just twitter.com/aftermathshow. So you got a variation there between Aftermath Show, ttaftermath@gmail.com, and then throughtheaftermath.blogspot.com. So we have those, and if anyone... You know, definitely send us email. We'd love to read those things on the air and talk about them and discuss them. Anything that we've talked about today, or you know, a future idea for another show, any of that stuff, we'll read it all. So I guess that's about it. So until next time, this is Sean.
And this is Jonathan saying, I just realized that a week from now would be 2 years for this show. I can't believe I just figured that out.
Oh, nice.
Talk about the closing thought of the century. I didn't even say stay alive out there, because apparently we have so far.